Listen to the voices of our world.
The race of the people who live around a hospital predicts which hospitals are more likely to close and which hospitals are likely to stay open.
I'm a white male myself. If I refuse to acknowledge that I've had those benefits, that is an anti-democratic position.
Race is a factor decade after decade.
Welcome to Voices of Our World, a presentation of this station and Mary Knoll. I'm Eileen Bott. Racism is alive and well. Today we'll hear Dr. Sager's findings that race is one of the strongest reasons for hospital closings. And Martin Carnoy discusses the current myth that race is a thing of the past. He demonstrates how African Americans are blamed for social inequalities and offers remedies by changing our institutions. When I walked my dog on Saturday, I ran into a friend that I had not seen in a few months. We stood on the corner and talked about school and work and settling into her new apartment. She loves where she lives, but getting used to new neighbors is a different matter. She said she felt invisible, unwelcome, like she didn't belong on her block. Her downstairs neighbors didn't ever say hello in the morning. I said that we live in New York, a big city. Not everyone is friendly. She explained that she had moved into a two-family house. When she knocks on their door to give them their mail, they peek through the door and ask her to leave it outside. I asked if these were little kids with explicit instructions from their parents not to open the door. She said that these were adults, that she was no stranger, that she sees them every day, and that she'd been introduced to them countless times by the owner of the building. Her story continued with egregious examples of rude behavior, and I kept on suggesting reasons for why this could happen. I just couldn't understand. And then she said that people only recognize their own brown people. In other words, white people only recognize the people of color they have to deal with or need a service from. All others are invisible. Yes, folks, racism exists. It's alive and well. It's easy to recognize as hate speech from the mouths of white supremacists, but its more subtle form is everywhere. Even I refuse to use racism as the reason for continuous poor treatment of my African-American friend by her white neighbors. I couldn't understand it. She is a human being, a person who should be treated as well as I am, and we are living close to 50 years after the empowerment of the civil rights movement. While conservatives convey that racism is a thing of the past, they go further to blame lack of progress on the victims themselves, proclaiming that they are lazy. Martin Carnoy is one of several authors who worked in collaboration to produce the book, Whitewashing Race, The Myth of a Colorblind Society. The book argues that racism is inherent in the organization of the labor market, the criminal justice system, schools, and universities. Reasons for continued, persistent racial inequality must be remedied by changing our institutions. Eleanor Ostrinsky speaks to Martin Carnoy.
Why did you call the book Whitewashing Race?
Because I think the book is an answer to politically motivated view of race, which is that it's disappeared as an issue in America, and it's been whitewashed. So that's the myth of the colorblind society.
Why do you think so many people believe that race is no longer an issue?
I think it's a convenient belief. It's as convenient as men believing that women were always equal and that they chose to be wives and mothers and they could have always been something else, but this is what they chose to do. I mean, it's convenient for the people who have benefited from that belief to believe that this has nothing to do with the way they organize the society. It has to do with the fact that the people in question, whether it be women, whether it be people of color, that they have not taken advantage of the opportunities that were available to them.
In your book, you say that race is a relationship, not a set of characteristics. And I thought that was a very powerful statement. Since the beginning of the 50s and 60s, strides have been made. And then really in the last few years, we've gone back in time. Can you talk about those
trends? I think the 80s, with the Reagan administration, the notion of racial discrimination was changed from what was called in the 70s statistical discrimination, in which you just had to prove that there was discrimination if statistically things did not turn out to be proportional. For example, at the University of Mississippi, there are 9% black students in a state which has 36% black population. So you could make the argument at the University of Mississippi is discriminating against black students because they're not anywhere near the population proportion in the state, and it is a state university. After 1980, the Reagan administration redefined racial discrimination. Each individual had to prove that they, as an individual, were discriminated against. That's a much harder case to prove, and as a result, there were far fewer discrimination cases. The other big setback is on affirmative action, which is recognized as a way to try to compensate for past discrimination by taking account of who you are as a member of a group in order to give you better access either to education or to government contracts, so that consideration was taken of race, ethnicity, and gender. That has suffered a series of setbacks. For the most part, race cannot be used as a criterion for either government contracts or for admission to colleges.
Why do some white people feel that, you know, affirmative action is actually something that discriminates against them?
If you believe that all people are basically starting on a level playing field, then the idea of giving some people a break is discrimination. They believe that the fact that black students go to schools in which the teachers aren't nearly as good and in which there are no advanced placement courses and they don't have the resources to take the SAT test four times and have coaching, if they believe that that's equal playing field, then they're going to feel discriminated against. In the 1970s and early 80s, the relative test scores of blacks and Hispanics did go way up. And one of the main reasons is that the poverty rate went way down, in part because of affirmative action. So you got a vicious circle. You undo affirmative action, you reduce the possibility for the poverty rate going down, and then if you reduce the possibility for the poverty rate going down, you reduce the possibility for the test scores going up. Because clearly poverty is a big issue in where they live and what kind of schools they go to. You can claim that people should get the right test scores to get into the universities and then they have the right to go to them and complete them. Or you can figure out that the universities also have an obligation to make sure that everybody has the same chance to finish and that that chance to finish is high. Because today, it's really important to finish university to get a decent job. There was just a suit by 700 people of color, had 1,200 or above on their SATs, and had 4-point GPA, and didn't get into Berkeley. But they're trying to show that they didn't have any of the advantages of the other kids, and that they were scoring close enough on the SAT that they should have gotten access to Berkeley. Berkeley has better facilities, better teachers. It's a research institution. This is what you want to get access to if you want to be successful. While those who have had all the benefits before, they continue to get access to the best institutions.
It seems that a lot of the success that has been, quote-unquote, earned by white people in this country has been a long-standing accumulation of policies that have really worked for white people.
Yeah, I'm a white male myself, so I had all those benefits. The problem is that if I refuse to acknowledge that I've had those benefits, that is an anti-democratic position. What that says is that I'm unwilling to create conditions in which we do move toward true equality. Now, the neoconservatives, they're going to come up with the policies that are going to now make it possible for individual blacks to overcome their faults rather than to look at the institutions in the society, change those institutions, make institutions that are truly more equal.
For example, in the labor market, there is not a level playing field.
I've done a lot of empirical analysis of labor markets. And among high school graduates and those with some college, if you're black or Hispanic, you're going to be getting a lower salary.
You spoke in your book about wealth creation and attacking racism by changing poverty. Can you give some examples of what are some strategies for wealth creation?
One of the main sources of wealth creation in the United States in the last 25 years has been home ownership and the growth of the value of your home. If you have greater difficulty owning a home because your loans are being redlined, meaning that your bank will not lend to you because you're black or Hispanic, you're going to have more difficulty buying a home. And if you buy a home, your interest rates are going to be higher, so you're accumulating less wealth. The second problem is that in a typical black family or Hispanic family, it's likely that only one person or two people that have been able to accumulate some wealth. So the whole family comes to depend on that one person. So it's very hard for them to continue to accumulate wealth. Meanwhile, in a white family, if I'm able to get a good job, et cetera, I don't have to support 10 other people. And the other thing is, in general, we should recognize that affirmative action really has helped a lot of people, and we should be really considering pumping many more resources into low-income communities to try to break the vicious circle of poverty.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was interesting for me to read your book and think how the criminal justice system as well has devastated blacks and Latinos, which are overwhelmingly incarcerated because of discrimination, because of many other factors, and how it's taken effect on their communities in general.
It's a vicious circle, because if you're poor and of color and a male, you're more likely to be picked up, you're more likely to be judged guilty, you're more likely to end up in prison serving time, and then when you come out, you have a prison record, and so it's very difficult for you to get a decent job. But it's even beyond that. I mean, the Rush Limbaugh case is a pretty good one. The man has been doing drugs in huge amounts for years now. If you were a young black, you'd be in prison. And it's a very typical case. The fact is that there's a lot of white-collar crime. We're seeing it on the headlines every day. But those people are likely to be able to get out of becoming designated criminals. The other issue is the whole issue of the courts and of the justice system. I mean, we really have to do something about this, because the idea that we should have the whole justice system focusing on a group of people who are probably the amount of resources that are involved in these petty crimes is really quite small and affects people much less than these huge white-collar crimes that are really on a mega scale compared to what's going on at the bottom. And the justice system is really organized to take care of the stuff at the bottom, not the stuff at the top. And I think this is the issue. The society is defining certain kinds of people as being the problem, and then telling them, oh, you're really on an equal playing field, but you are the problem. So, and we're going to treat you as if you're the problem.
That's exactly what your book is about, whitewashing race.
And suggesting a lot of ways to improve the situation, but it focuses on fixing institutions, not fixing individual people who happen to be black and Hispanic.
Thank you very much for coming on with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Everyone agrees that all are created equal, but do you choose to live in a mixed neighborhood? Would you hire a lawyer that looks different from you? What do you do to make others feel welcome? Give us your opinion. Email us at radio@maryknoll.org or go to our website, www.voicesofourworld.org. Just click on Contact Us. Or you can call us at 877-MARY-KNOLL. That's 877-MARY-KNOLL. You're listening to Voices of Our World.